Chapter 52. It's a mixture of starches taken from rice powder along with the addition of a naturally occurring accelerant that makes it plump up, Nixon said. Tseng was staring at the courtyard surrounding the Dome of the Rock. A Muslim CIA agent, who was assigned to Israel, was carefully removing Abraham's stone from the crust. The heavy object had penetrated the surface over a foot, but was still cushioned by inches of the white blanket. The CIA agent looked up at Tseng and nodded that the stone was secure.
"How do we get this stuff off the courtyard?" Tseng asked.
"I didn't have much time to test that," Nixon said, "but vinegar should do the trick." Tseng nodded, then reached onto his belt and removed a folding knife. He reached down and cut a square into the white blanket. Prying with the knife, he pulled up the chunk and held it in his hand. "It's like a rice cake," he said, tossing the feather-light square in the air and catching it again. "If we have someone cut it up with shovels," Nixon said, "then remove the biggest pieces, followed by wetting the area with vinegar and brushing it with brooms. I think all it'll need then is a good hosing off." The sound of the Robinson grew louder. The helicopter passed over the mosque, then landed on a nearby street. Tseng was giving the Israelis instructions on the cleanup when Cabrillo walked through the arched gate and into the courtyard. "The wreckage of the DC-3 landed in the Dead Sea," Cabrillo said to Tseng. "The largest piece we could see on the surface was about the size of a loaf of bread."
"And Mr. Hickman?" Tseng asked.
"Whatever remains exist," Cabrillo said. "Sleep with the fishes." Tseng nodded, and the men stood quietly for a moment.
"Sir," Tseng said a moment later, "the stone is secured and the cleanup of the mosque has been initiated. The teams are ready for extraction."
Cabrillo nodded.
"You're cleared for extraction," he said, turning to the CIA agent. "Bring the stone and come with me."
Placing the carefully wrapped stone into a wheelbarrow used by the gardeners at the mosque, the CIA agent grabbed the handles and followed Cabrillo toward the gate. At the same time Cabrillo was walking toward the Robinson, Hanley was conferring with Overholt over the telephone.
"We've secured the stone and are withdrawing from Israel," Hanley said. "How are your contacts in Egypt?"
"Excellent," Overholt said.
"And the Sudan?"
"Our man there is top-notch."
"Here's what we need," Hanley said.
Overholt made notes as Hanley explained.
"Okay,"
he said when Hanley finished.
"Al-Kadarka Aswan and Ras Abu Shagara, Sudan. I'll arrange the clearances and have 100-octane fuel at each stop."
Hanley was just disconnecting as Halbert walked into the control room holding a file folder stuffed with papers.
"I think I have Medina figured out," he said. "I lifted the blueprints from the contractor's computer base and studied them for the last hour."
"Blueprints?" Hanley asked.
"It was built hundreds of years ago."
"But enlarged and modernized, 1985 through 1992, Halbert said. "At that time, they bored underground tunnels to run water lines for an air conditioning system. You told me to think like Hickman. If I was him, that's where I'd place charges."
Hanley stared at the diagrams for a moment.
"Michael," he said a second later, "I think you nailed it."
"Remember that," Halbert said, smiling, "at bonus time."
Halbert walked out of the control room and Hanley reached for a telephone. While the number was ringing, he turned to Stone.
"Pull up a satellite shot of Medina for me."
Stone began to enter commands into the computer just as the phone was answered.
"Yes, sir," Kasim said.
"What's the progress?"
Kasim was standing just off to the side of a crowd of people at the Jeddah bus terminal.
"Both teams made it safely here," Kasim said. "We stashed the motorcycles in a dry wash outside of Jeddah and made our way into the city. Scudder, who's heading the Medina operation, and his team have already boarded a bus for the city. My team and I are waiting for ours now.
And Scudder has a satellite phone with him?
Yes, sir.
How long until his bus arrives?
Hanley asked. 4 to 5 hours, Kasim said.
I'll wait until he arrives to call him, but we think we know where the charges were placed at the Prophet's Mosque.
The bus was just pulling up. My bus is here, Kasim said. What do you want us to do?
You'll be met by a CIA contact in Mecca and taken to a safe house,
Hanley said.
I'll call you there.
Got it. Pete Jones looked over to the Emir of Qatar. Your Excellency, he said, how are your relations with the Bahrainis?
Great, the Emir said. They are dear friends.
Can you have trucks waved through customs without any problems?
I'm sure I can.
Do you have a cargo ship available that can pick them up at the port in Bahrain?
The Emir stared over at his aide, Aldani.
I'll arrange one here or in Bahrain immediately, Aldani said.
We have about 6 hours before everything needs to be in place, Jones said.
It shall be done, Mr. Jones, the Emir said. It shall be done.
Inside the fenced cargo area alongside Riyadh Airport, U.S. Army Warrant Officer Patrick Colgan and his team were still awaiting instructions. They had spent 3 nights hiding under the containers, eating from their food supplies and drinking their bottled water. Now supplies were running low on both, and the containers around them that gave them cover were growing thinner and thinner. Something needed to happen, and happen quickly. Jones studied the file taken from Al-Sheikh's PDA, then reached for the telephone.
Sir, he said when the phone was answered, have you received any changes to the shipping time for the cargo containers?
No changes,
Hanley said.
Okay, then, Jones said. I've got the out.
Hanley listened while Jones explained.
I like it. Simple and sweet.
I'm cleared?
Do it,
Hanley said. The area around the 3 shipping containers where the men were hiding was gradually being cleared. There was still a scattering of containers to the left, but to the right was only bare sand and gravel. Colgan's telephone rang quietly, and he pushed the button to answer.
Colgan, he said.
This is Jones and Cotter.
What have you got for us, Mr. Jones? We are nearly out in the open here. We need to do something quick.
In 10 minutes, 3 trucks are due to arrive to pick up the containers,
Jones said.
The trucks all have GPS locators attached to the rear of the cabs. The locators are about the size of a pack of cigarettes and are secured by a magnet. Have 3 of your men act as lot workers, helping the trucks hook up. Have the men remove the locators as the trucks back in, otherwise you'll be tracked.
Okay, Colgan said.
Tell the 3 men with the locators to attach them to an uncontaminated container, then have them jump into another truck and catch a ride to Mecca. The people tracking the shipment should just think that the trucks are following close behind each other.
What should my men do when they reach Mecca?
Jump out of the trucks before they reach the unloading terminal and discard the locators in the first trash cans they see. Then they need to catch a bus down to Jeddah and make their way to the port area. Once there, they'll find a shore launch marked Akbar 2. Have them board the boat, and they'll be transported offshore.
Akbar 2, Colgan repeated.
Now, the 5 of you that remain will have to overpower the drivers and take the trucks yourselves. Bind and gag the drivers and place them on the passenger side, on the floor. Then simply drive through the gate. And when you reach the main road, go east instead of west. Your ultimate destination is Bahrain.
Okay, Colgan said.
Now,
Jones said,
since after the 3 leave for Mecca, you still have 5 men. You'll be crowded in 2 of the trucks. Your driver and passenger plus the bound and gagged one you've overpowered. Make sure your extra man ducks under the blanket when you pull from the gate so they don't notice.
Won't they stop and check us? Colgan asked.
We've had someone watching the gate today,
Jones said.
They check for the correct truck on the way in, then they just mark down the container number as it passes loaded through the gate.
But what happens when the cargo is missing and they find the locators? Glogan said. Won't they start looking for us then?
The trip from Riyadh to Mecca takes 6 hours,
Jones said.
It's only 4 to Bahrain. Once they figure out the containers are missing, you'll be on a cargo ship bound for Qatar.
And you're sure we can make it through the border checkpoint into Bahrain?
It's all been taken care of.
Sweet plan, Colgan said.
Good luck.
15 minutes later, Colgan and the other 4 men bound for Bahrain made it safely out of the cargo terminal and started down the road. 7 minutes after that, a Coast Guard petty officer named Perkins, along with 2 others, attached the locators to 3 trucks in a 6-truck convoy, then climbed inside the last truck. The truck was filled with bottles of water, so at least they would not be thirsty on the 6-hour haul to Mecca. If only the truck had had a pallet of M&Ms aboard, the ride would have been more enjoyable. It was almost noon when Adams, Cabrillo, and the CIA agent handling Abraham Stone landed at the first fuel stop at Al-Kardaka, Egypt, at the mouth of Khalij Aswez on the entrance to the Red Sea. Overholt not only had the promised fuel, but food, water, coffee, and a U.S. Army helicopter mechanic to check the R-44. The mechanic added 1/2 a can of oil to the piston engine and did a quick check of the craft, then pronounced the Robinson fit as a fiddle. The 3 men made a quick bathroom stop, then took off again. The next leg of the flight, some 200 miles to Aswan, was made in less than 2 hours at a speed of 125 miles per hour. The helicopter was fueled and checked again, and the trio set off. Aswan to Ras Abu Shagara, the dangling peninsula of land that jutted into the Red Sea across from Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, was the longest leg of the flight, some 350 miles in length. The flight would take nearly 3 hours. The Robinson was 30 minutes out of Aswan, high above the desert, when Adams spoke.
"Sirs," he said, "it'll be a couple of hours until the next stop. If you want to get some sleep, it's okay by me."
The CIA agent in the rear seat nodded, crouched down, and pulled his hat down over his eyes.
"You okay, George?" Cabrillo asked. "You've been flying a lot lately. How are you holding up?"
"I'm 10 by 10, boss," Adams said, smiling. "I'll take us down to the Sudan, then across the Red Sea and drop you. Once I'm back in Sudan, I'll get some shut-eye."
Cabrillo nodded. Slowly, as the helicopter droned south, he fell into a sleep. The time was just after 4 p.m. when Hanley on the Oregon made the satellite call to Scudder. With no clear direction yet on how to proceed, Scudder and his team had been milling around the bus terminal, waiting for a contact.
"My name is Max Hanley. I'm Mr. Kasim's superior."
"What do you want us to do?"
Scudder asked quickly. Several people had approached his team already, and only one of the men with him could speak even a smattering of Arabic. If they stayed here any longer, they might be detected.
"To your left," Hanley said, "is a beggar with an old tin plate who looks like he's sleeping. Do you see him?"
"Yes,"
Scudder said. In between bouts of what looked like napping, the man had been staring at his team for the last 20 minutes.
"Go over to him and place a coin in his plate," Hanley said.
"We don't have any coins,"
Scudder whispered.
"We were only issued bills."
"Then use the smallest bill you have," Hanley said. "He will hand you what looks like a religious pamphlet. Take the pamphlet, walk a safe distance away from the terminal to a side street, then find somewhere you can read it without being observed."
"Then what?"
"Your instructions are inside."
"Is that all?"
Scudder asked.
"For now," Hanley said, "and good luck."
Scudder disconnected, then whispered to one of his men. Then he walked over to the beggar, removed a bill from a stack in his pocket, bent over, and slipped it on the plate.
"Allah will reward you,"
the beggar said in Arabic, handing him the pamphlet.
Scudder was bending back to an upright position when the briefest of winks flickered across the beggar's left eye. Suddenly, Scudder was feeling a renewed hope. Making his way away from the bus station, followed by the other men, he found a deserted area and read the instructions. It was only a few blocks to his destination, and he ate the entire pamphlet as he walked. "Do not go outside," the CIA contact said to Kasim and his team at the safe house in Mecca. "Do not do anything to draw attention to yourself. There is food, water, and soft drinks in the kitchen." "How do we reach you if we need to?" Kasim asked. "You don't," the contact said. "You wait for your people to give you any further instructions. I was told to stock the house, meet you at the terminal, and bring you here. That ends my involvement. I wish you luck and Godspeed." The CIA man made his way to the door and exited. "That seems odd," an army private in Kasim's team offered. "Everything is compartmentalized," Kasim said. "Each piece of this operation will remain separate until it's time to bring it together. Now, we all need to get some rest and take turns getting cleaned up. I want everyone to eat a good meal and try to relax. Soon we will be called, and when we are, it'll be go time." The team nodded. The sun was setting as Adams approached the Akbar from the Red Sea. Passing over the yacht once to alert the crew, he lined up over the stern and dropped slowly down. Al-Khalifa's Kawasaki helicopter was still on the heliport, so he hovered a few feet above the yacht, just above a clear spot on the stern. The CIA agent dropped Abraham Stone, safely packed in a box with padding, to the deck, then leapt off. "Overholt's men are waiting for you back at Ras Abu Shagara," Cabrillo said. "Will you be okay?" "Yes, sir," Adams said. The CIA agent was carrying the box toward the rear door of the Akbar. Cabrillo stepped off and crab-walked out from under the rotor blade. Adams lifted off again. At just that moment, Cabrillo's phone rang.
"Threat one is eliminated," Hanley said. "The cargo containers are on board a ship just now leaving Bahrain for Qatar."
"No problems?"
"All went as planned,"
Hanley said.
"Three men will meet the Akbar's shore boat in Jeddah. You'll need to have them transported out to the yacht. Their part of the operation is finished."
Kent Joseph, part of a Florida team who had been contracted to handle the Akbar for the corporation, poked his head out of the door, and Cabrillo smiled and raised his finger for the captain to wait a minute. "Scudder!"
"He has the diagrams, and we're sending him and the team in this evening,"
Hanley said.
"If that's successful, it'll be two down and one to go."
"How are you coming on that plan?" Cabrillo asked.
"I'll call you back soon."
The telephone went dead, and Cabrillo placed it in his pocket. Then he smiled and reached his hand out to Joseph. "Juan Cabrillo," he said, shaking. "I'm with the corporation."
"Is that like the agency?" Joseph asked.
"Heck no," Cabrillo said, smiling. "I'm not a spy." Joseph nodded and motioned to the door.
"But he is,"
Cabrillo said, waving toward the CIA agent.